Wake up, America. Time to stump the experts. And now, here's our master of ceremonies, Clifton Fadiman.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Spontaneous and unrehearsed as ever, we swing along tonight with our quartet of experts. They consist of our two veterans, John Kieran of the New York Sun, and Franklin P. Adams, the sage of Western Connecticut. Our guests are our good and well-loved friend, the novelist and critic, Christopher Morley, and as an extra special attraction, the fabulous Esme of Paris, a lady who dances, plays the piano, trains animals, and, just to make a living, bottles and sells perfume. A recently published autobiography, Esme of Paris, has attracted much attention. And now, ladies and gentlemen, I have been asked by the producer of this program, Mr. Dan Golenthal, to make this announcement. For information, please. And I quote, "We have received some letters from listeners objecting to the fact that from time to time our guests have expressed an opinion on a controversial subject. We recognize that this has happened, and if it were a general practice, we ourselves would object, because information, please, is not a forum. Nevertheless, on an ad lib spontaneous program, such expressions of opinion are bound to occur. They're part of the unpredictable pattern of information, please. We don't invite them. We don't endorse them. But we do respect them as the spontaneous utterances of men and women who are outstanding and responsible in their fields. Now, our listeners expect information, please, to be spontaneous and unrehearsed. We want to keep it that way. And so information, please, is willing to take its chances with our guests ad-libbing rather than depart from the unpredictable pattern of the show." Close quote. And now, ladies and gentlemen, we'll start our spontaneous and unpredictable program this evening with a question from Louise V. Clary of Albany, New York. And let's get 2 out of 3 on this if we can. This question all has to do with things that ran in one way or another. For example, who or what ran down? Who or what ran down? Mr. Morley.
The old one-hoss shay.
Well, I'm thinking of course it did, you're quite right.
The mouse ran down the clock.
That's the one, Mr. Morley. The mouse ran down. The clock struck one, the mouse ran down. Hickory dickory dock. Now, who or what ran away? Who or what ran away, Mr. Adams?
The dish.
Oh.
Ran away with a spoon.
Yes, quite right. Yes, you want, Mr. Kieran?
Georgie Porgy.
Georgie Porgy, very good.
When the girls came out to play, Georgie Porgy ran away.
Perfectly true, yes. And who or what wouldn't run? Wouldn't run. Mr. Morley.
Calvin Coolidge didn't choose to.
That's quite right. When did he make that statement, Mr. Morley?
Why?
When did he make it?
When?
Yes.
Oh, toward the end of his term?
1927, yes. I do not choose to run for President of the United States in 1928.
He was up very high in the mountains at the time. It was the thin air, I think.
Went to his head?
Wasn't he in
Colorado?
Dakota.
Was he?
What memory you gentlemen have. Well, that gives us 3 rans out of 3. Now, try this from Connie Dick of Mount Airy, Pennsylvania, and I think we should get all on this. It's a musical question. If this music were used as the theme song by an advertiser, what would he be selling? Let's have the first.
It'd help to know what it was.
It would help, yes. It would help. That's very shrewd of you, Mr. Adams. Would you care to give us one of those splendid guesses of yours, Mr. Adams? You're making a bad mistake.
No, I dare not.
Dare not. If it isn't Mozart, you just don't know. Mr. Morley?
Well, I can only give the impression it conveys to me as a man who didn't have rubber heels and then decided to put them on.
Well, unless I'm mistaken, that's from The Miller's Dance, from The Three-Cornered Hat defies The Miller's Dance, and so the advertiser would be selling what, if that's The Miller's?
Hats and Danbury.
Hats and Danbury, or he might be selling flour, yes. Now let's have the second of these, Mr. Kahn. I have 2 hands. Esme?
That's the Tchaikovsky's Waltz of the Flowers.
Quite right. And the advertiser would be selling in that case?
Flowers.
Presumably, yes. Quite right. You see how easy this is? I don't see why you're in the perfume business. Let's have the third and last, Mr. Cohen. I have the eminent musico, Mr. Kieran, over here.
Why, he would be selling dancing dolls.
Why?
Poldinis. Poupée dansant, I believe.
Oh, yes, that's quite right, Mr. Kieran. Have you ever played that yourself, Mr. Kieran?
Oh, I can tinkle it, but very badly.
Well, we'll stick to Mr. Kahn. But we were to get 3 out of 3 on that.
Fine.
And now, here's one for Mr. and Mrs. E.M. Patterson of Savannah, Georgia. Get 2 out of 3 on this. Could the following people have owned these books? Now, this is a question of dating these people properly. Could Keats have owned a copy of Shelley's Adonais? Esme?
Yes, I think so. They were friends.
Well, now, you have to be very careful about that one. They were, to an extent, friends. Mr. Morley?
Unfortunately not, because Adonais was written in memory of Keats.
Yes, it was in memory of an elegy written on the death of Keats. They were contemporaries, Esme, as you indicate. But that particular poem, of course, written about Keats after his death, he could not have owned, for obvious reasons. But that gives us one wrong. Now, could Darwin, Charles Darwin, have owned a copy of the Rubaiyat of Omar Khayyam? Well, that is again a question of dating these folks. Mr. Kieran?
Well, let's see. Darwin?
Yes,
I think yes. I think he
yes
could
is
have.
Right.
Because, well, although they weren't far apart, you know, they lived contemporaneously.
Sure. When did the poem, the Rubaiyat of Omar Khayyam, generally bound in plush, and Darwin's Origin of Species appear?
I don't remember, but Fitzgerald was a friend of Tennyson and those people, and he lived 1840, 50, 60, 70, around there, and Darwin lived about the same time.
In the 50s, that's right. Both published.
They were both published in the very famous year, 59. A number of other great books published at that time. Both appeared in 59. Darwin could have owned a copy of the Rubaiyat. There's no indication from the Origin of Species, at any rate, that he did.
He'd have been very lucky. There were only about 100 copies of that first edition.
True enough, but he wasn't a first edition collector. He was nuts about beetles and stuff like that. Now, could George Washington, Esme and gentlemen, could George Washington have owned a set of the Encyclopedia Britannica? Mr. Adams.
Yes, I think he could have.
What makes you think he could have? That's
because,
quite right, Mr. Adams.
Because the Encyclopedia Britannica was, the first one was, I think, 1700 and something.
Yes, so during your best years.
Before he died.
1768. It could have gone, matter of fact, between 68 and 97, it went through 3 editions. By the way, do you know, Mr. Adams, whether Washington actually did own an Encyclopedia Britannica?
I don't know whether he did, but Parson Weems used to sell it.
There's a rumor current, Mr. Winch will take notice, that he did own an Encyclopedia Britannica, which he bought. He didn't win it on this show. He actually bought it. Well, that gives us 2 out of 3. Mrs. Gary Young of Evanston, Illinois, sends this one in, and I think we should get all on this. What might each of these people contribute in the making of perfume? What might a miner contribute to the making of scents of various sorts? Mr. Morley?
Coal tar.
Yes. What is that used for in the making of perfume?
Well, they always speak of it as a coal tar derivative, but just how it's derived, Esme better tell us.
Esme, can you help us out? You are in this business.
Yes, I'm not very familiar with coal tar, except the soap for washing dogs. I don't know what we get the perfumes out of it. But I know most of it.
Well, apparently some synthetic perfumes use
coal. It's a kind of binder, coal, I think, isn't it?
Possibly.
It's probably used as a fixative in synthetics.
Fixative, that's the word. Whenever they talk about perfumes, they use the word fixative. Let's stick to that, Mr. Morley. Now, what might a deep-sea fisherman contribute to Mr. Adams?
Ambergris.
What is ambergris?
Comes from a whale.
Yes, it does. So where, in what part of the whale do you generally find it?
I don't know. It's too indefinite.
Mr. Morley?
I think it comes from somewhere at the back of the whale's mouth, doesn't it?
Well, I think it's found in the alimentary canal, Mr. Kieran.
It's a disease. It's a growth.
Well, it's on its way to the
extraneous growth.
It's in his mouth.
Yes, it's a kind of a morbid secretion, nasty stuff. But, Esme, isn't it useful in the making of...
Yes, and very expensive and hard to get and most useful.
Well, the whales hate to give it up, you know. And now, what would a butcher contribute to the making of perfume? A butcher. Mr. Morley, I had no idea this was your field.
I should think kinds of fats and oils.
Well, that's quite
fatty,
right. Beef and pork.
Sebaceous matter.
But why? How would that be useful? Esme, do you have
you got to help me.
I'm going to give Mr. Morley a perfect on that, even though
I
he doesn't know why he says what he does.
Pleasant to make it adhesive.
Well, that's to give me a good hint.
What
might
a salesman.
Make it thick.
It's something like that. Well, shall I read you what I have on my card, Mr. Morley? This is very useful information. It's used, beef and pork fat is used in something called enfleurage. That's the process by which the petals of certain flowers are laid on fat until their perfume is absorbed, because their perfumes cannot be preserved in any other way. Do you find that fascinating? You like that, Mr. Adams? But you can't remember a word I said. Mr. Kieran?
I think most of the perfumes are made in the chemist shop these days.
Oh, you bring us down to such a sordid level, Mr. Kieran. Well, that gives us 3 out of 3 on that.
And now Morton Gould and the orchestra take over for 2 minutes and 19 seconds as they play Body and Soul.
Esme and gentlemen, John G. Hall, Ontario, Canada, sends this one in and asks us to get all 3 parts. In what sport or occupation does a participant carry darts with bright streamers at one end? Esme?
For the corrida, the bullfighting.
Yes, that's right. Which of the boys who... there are several kinds of people who participate in bullfighting. What are those called who carry the... streamered darts. Mr. Morley?
I think they're the picadors.
No, I think they're not the picadors.
Bandolieros.
Bandolieros. Will that be right, Esme?
Yes, that's correct.
I don't know which... Have you seen bullfights, Esme?
Yes, many of them.
Have you been in one?
Well, I've watched them.
Oh, I'm so surprised if you haven't been in a bullfight. You seem to have done almost everything else. Mr. Morley, have you ever been in a bullfight?
I've been in the ring, but not in the fight. When I was in Peru, it was the off-season, so I went around the bull ring there to see what it felt like.
And that's how you happen to know about the banderilleros. How about a sport or occupation in which a participant is weighed with all his clothes on? Mr. Adams.
Horse racing,
yes. Who is it that's weighed with all the clothes on?
Sometimes Brooks and sometimes Atkinson and any other jockey.
Mr. Garrett?
He's weighed with more than his clothes on. He's weighed carrying his saddle, too.
Why?
Because that's part of the weight that the horse must carry, and also any lead weights that may be in the pockets of the saddle.
You do know a great deal about the seamy side of life, Mr. Karen. And what sport or occupation does a participant carry a whip and a chair? A whip and a chair. Esme.
Lion taming. Any wild animal cage work.
And why does one do that, Esme?
Well, the chair is to hold off a possible attack, and the whip is generally to either to time or to use in an emergency.
You say that pretty coolly. But why a chair, and how do you handle chairs? It always seemed to me a very difficult thing to lift one of those things.
Well, you just keep a chair in the cage till the four points of the chair form a shield.
Yeah.
And the animal very seldom will get into that on account of its eyes, and it might try to claw it, but that's about all it would do.
Do you like this kind of work, Esme?
Mm-hmm.
You like you going back to it sometime?
Oh, I don't think so, no.
Oh, it's a shame. It's tough on the animals, too. Well, that gives us 3 out of 3 on that. Mrs. Beatrice S. Ortiz of Chicago sends this one in. Asks you to get all. To what character of literature do these words about growth apply? They all have to do with growing. Aspect I growed. Mr. Adams.
That is from Uncle Tom's Cabin.
And who says that?
Topsy.
Topsy, yes. Do you know what she goes on to say? It's a famous little speech. Mr. Kieran, do you remember it?
Well, she was asked when she was born. She said she wasn't born. She just growed.
Yes.
So.
Don't think nobody never made me, she said. Now, to what character of literature will these words apply? Grown so great. Grown so great. Mr. Kieran.
Julius Caesar, upon what meat hath this our Caesar fed?
Yes, that he has grown so great. That's hitting it very accurately. And here is one more quotation about growth. Grow old along with me. To whom does that apply, Mr. Morley?
That's one of Browning's poems. I think it's The Last Ride Together, isn't it?
We got the wrong poem and the right author. Mr. Kieran's going to straighten us out.
Rabbi Ben Ezra.
Oh, yes.
Rabbi Ben Ezra, yes. I think I'll have to count that wrong, Mr. Morley, because it has to be... a character, and you've got the wrong character. Ernest E. Berglund of Leroy, Minnesota, wants you to try this one. Why does a pig roll in the mud? Why does a pig roll in the mud? Mr. Kieran?
Well, mostly to keep cool in the summertime.
Yes, and why to keep cool?
Well, because the water is cooler than the air.
But why don't you roll in the mud, Mr. Kieran?
What?
If you wanted to keep cool, would you roll in the mud?
Well, I'm not a pig.
Ah, but that's exactly what I'm getting at. In a word, what distinguishes you from a pig? Oh, don't go into it, Mr. Adams. Mr. Adams?
You mean Kieran or me?
I'll take either one of you.
I think a pig does not sweat in the summer.
Oh, that's exactly right. It has no sweat glands, that's right. And rolling in the mud helps it out. It also helps to keep off insects. Did you know that, Mr. Kieran?
Well, a good smack of mud will knock an insect off.
Agreed.
Yes, I know that.
Now, why, Esme and gentlemen, why does a chicken swallow pebbles and sand? Mr. Kieran?
That is to help grind up its food.
That's quite right. And why should it do that,
because
Mr. Adams?
Because food passes through those...
Yes, but there's a particular defect the chicken has, I mean, as compared with you, Mr. Kieran.
Oh, well, I have, I hope I have some peptic juices that will dissolve larger fragments than
True.
Is possible in a chicken.
But you have something else the chicken doesn't have, Mr. Morley.
Teeth.
Teeth, yes. Don't you have any teeth, Mr. Kieran?
Oh, yes, I have a few.
How many did you say you had?
Shall I ganache them at you?
Chicken has no teeth, and the stones help grind up the food, as Mr. Kieran tells us, for digestive purposes. Now, why does an ostrich hide its head in the sand? Mr. Kieran, again.
It doesn't.
Quite
Never.
Right, it doesn't. How did that legend ever arise, do you
Well, suppose? Because, you see, ostriches at a distance, if they have their heads down feeding, the head is a very small part of an ostrich. You can just imagine which part of an ostrich is the largest part when it has its head down feeding.
Agreed.
So people think at a distance that the ostrich is hiding and has its head in the sand. Its head merely is practically invisible from a distance.
Well, that's the first reasonable explanation I've ever heard of that legend. Mr. Adams, as an old ostrich fancier, did you have something you wanted to add to that?
I knew that was true because I read that in an old Audubon book.
Oh, you knew it was true, too. Can't fool either of you, gentlemen. Nance Cunningham of Houston, Texas, sends this one in. Get 2 out of 3. What was the profession or occupation of these adventurers, of fact or fiction? Lola Montez. What was Lola Montez's resume?
She was a famous Spanish dancer. Became the friend of the King of Bavaria.
That's putting it very nicely, yes. And she wasn't... Would you say she was a Spanish dancer? Was she really Spanish?
I'm not absolutely sure about that, but
where was she born?
I don't know.
She was born in Limerick.
Irish.
Yes, she was Irish. Mr. Adams, do you know anything about Lola Montez?
No, but I don't think that was her name.
I'll tell you what her name was. Would you like to know what her name was? You're absolutely right, Mr. Adams. Her real name was Marie Dolores Eliza Rosanna Gilbert. She was born in Limerick, Ireland, and she adopted the name of Lola Montez for business reasons. Claimed to be of Spanish origin, yes. Now, Casanova had an occupation, a number of them. Mr. Morley.
It sounds unlikely, but he was a librarian.
Yes, it does sound unlikely.
He ended up as a librarian.
Yes.
But he wasn't a librarian for many years.
Yes, and they were his best years, too. Well, Mr. Curran, in addition to being a librarian, and Mr. Morley, Mr. Adams?
I think he was a silversmith.
Casanova? I think you're thinking of Benvenuto Cellini.
I certainly am.
Who
and
had
Paul
the
Revere.
Same other hobby, Mr. Adams. I can understand the confusion in your mind. And enjoy it. Mr. Curran?
Casanova was a professional gambler.
Yes, he was. He
among
was
other things.
Among other things, yes. He was a director of state lotteries. And
well, that's still right within the gambling joint.
Quite true. What was his real name?
Chevalier de Saint-Gault.
That's quite right. Giovanni Jacopo Casanova de Saint-Gault. Now, Hugh Drummond had a profession or occupation. What was it? Hugh Drummond. I said that this might be an adventure of fiction. This is a fictional one. Mr. Morley?
I suppose you mean Bulldog Drummond.
I do indeed.
He was a soldier, and then he became a rescuer of fair young women.
Yes. He was an army officer with the rank of captain. You'd find him in what series of books?
Books by Sapper.
What? Sapper has a real name, too.
Yes.
Do you remember him?
H.A. McNeil.
That's quite right, Mr. Morley. Very good. He was a demobilized army officer.
Time for the orchestra and Morton Gould to take over while the experts gird themselves for the final round of questions.
Try this one for Mrs. J.A. Vale of New York City and get 2 out of 3. If the only words visible on different bill posters were these, would you know what each advertised? Now, all these words sound somewhat alike. The first word is Wells, the second is Fells, and the third is Sells. Now, the first is Wells. If you just saw that on a bill poster and the rest were torn off, what would it be advertising, do you think? Mr. Curran had his hand up
first. Well, it might be advertising a resort in England, Tunbridge Wells.
That's
a little recondite,
but very possible, Mr. Curran. Esme?
It could be advertising Sadler's Wells, the theater, Valley Theater in London.
Hadn't thought of that. That might be the case, Mr. Adams.
It could be a book advertising Macmillan's H.G.
Yes, probably true. All of these things are possible. The one I was thinking of was the Wells Fargo Express Company, a little nearer to us.
Haven't advertised in years.
You sound like a hungry advertising agent, Mr. Adams. Now, Fells. If you saw Fells, Mr. Morley.
Fells Naphtha Soap.
Fells Naphtha Soap. And if you saw the word Sells alone, Mr. Kieran.
Sells Floto Circus.
Yes, a famous traveling circus. Now, gentlemen, try this one from Alice Smith of New York City. Again, get 2 out of 3. Can you answer these questions about 3 names characteristic of different nationalities? In the name Lev Nikolaevich Tolstoy, what does the Nikolaevich indicate? Mr. Morley.
The son of Nicholas.
Yes, father's name was Nikolai or Nicholas.
And
the middle name
is what we call Leo.
Lev is the same as Leo, yes. The middle name of a Russian is his patronymic, derived from his father. Now, how about in the name Liam O'Flaherty, what does the O apostrophe mean? It has Esme?
It's of the family of. Or it corresponds to the French de so-and-so.
It's something like that, but not precisely. Precisely, it has a very exact meaning.
It's of the clan of.
Well, now, that's what I would have thought until it was looked up for us. It derives from the Gaelic a, or U-A, however that's pronounced, and it means grandchild. Therefore, the name originally meant a grandchild of Flaherty. Did you know that, Mr. Adams?
No.
No, well, he's just the same as I am. I didn't know it either. And that's what the O apostrophe means, grandchild. Now, how about in the name Jose Ortega y Gasset, what is indicated by y Gasset? Esme, do you know that one?
I didn't hear it very clearly.
I'll do it again for you.
And?
I'll give you a different pronunciation if you wish. In the name Jose Ortega y Gasset, what is indicated by y Gasset?
And Gasset.
And what does that mean?
It stands for and.
He does stand for and, but what does the Gasset indicate, Mr. Kieran?
They give you the mother and the father's name, both there.
That's quite right. The Ortega would be the father's name.
That's right.
And E is and, as may remind us, Gasset would be the mother's name. Well, we did get 2 out of 3 on that one. Now try this from John F. Vachon of Washington, District of Columbia, and get 2 out of 3. In whose paintings do these flowers or plants frequently appear? Sunflowers appear in whose paintings, Mr. Kieran?
Van Gogh.
Van Gogh is quite right. Where would you find lilies constantly appearing? Lilies as a motif in whose paintings? An American painter. Mr. Kieran?
Georgiana O'Keeffe?
Georgia O'Keeffe.
Georgia, yes, O'Keeffe.
Quite right. And finally, cactus. You'd find cactus appearing in whose paintings? Mr. Adams?
Might be Tom Benton.
I don't think so, though I'm not certain about that.
Well,
Mr.
there's 2 or 3 American painters. Ufa, a chap named Ufa does a lot of those.
That's a new one to me. I was thinking Mexican painters, Mr.
Oh.
Rivera, perhaps?
Orozco and
yes.
Rivera.
Well, that gives us 2 out of 3 on that, and that's all we'll have time for. Thank you, Esme, and thank you, Mr. Morley, for the fine cooperation this evening.
This is the Armed Forces Radio Service. ¶¶